Greetings. With poignance, we come to this last section in the psychology of self-perfection. And it will be the last section that we read together, at least in this round, in the yoga of self-perfection and the synthesis of yoga. It goes on for a number of chapters more, as you know. I think the last chapter in this series is chapter 73. From the time that Arya began all the way up to the end, and he regards towards the supramental time vision in that last chapter. Remembering where we were in the middle of this chapter, he had been speaking about the nature of spirit as power, and that the spirit has power as knowledge, as will, as process and action. Jnana Shakti, Icha Shakti, Kriya Shakti. It's worth noting as we begin that that is essentially Shloka 130 in Sri Lalita Sahasranama. Icha Shakti, Jnana Shakti, Kriya Shakti, Swarupini. This is her own form. This is her own form of being. Will, knowledge, power in action. She's not simply a blank spirit, but she who is real is conscious, is forceful, is effective. So if we live a truly spiritual life, we can bring spiritual power into our existence and effectuate what that Mahashakti wishes to achieve. We become co-agents, collaborators in her larger mission. Larger because it's beyond the human scope of vision. We can't gauge it or measure it. It's too swift, too large. So we'll take up this chapter with this sentence now. Purusha is able by this power of its nature to take whatever poise it may will and to follow the law and form of being proper to any self-formulation. Suggesting, of course, that Purusha can establish itself anywhere in a whole series of planes of its being and make that what seems to be its central focus, and adopt and adapt itself to whatever form is necessary and appropriate to the means of self-expression there. He continues, it is eternal soul and spirit in its own power of self-existence, superior to and governing its manifestations. It is universal soul and spirit developed in power of becoming of its existence, infinite in the finite. It is individual soul and spirit absorbed in development of some particular course of its becoming in appearance, mutably finite in the infinite. Its own power of self-existence, Swayambhu, a term that we're familiar with in the Upanishads. These three terms, the transcendent, the universal, and the individual, have dominated Sri Aurobindo's writings in the Arya from the moment he begins in 1914, in The Life Divine and in the Synthesis of Yoga. All three of these are poises of spiritual being and poises of self-expression, of self-containment, of santosha. The spirit is content to abide in any and all of these poises. All these things, it can be at once. Eternal spirit, universalized in cosmos, individualized in its beings. It can, too, found the consciousness, rejecting, governing, or responding to the action of nature in any one of them, put the others behind it or away from it, know itself as pure eternity, self-supporting universality, or exclusive individuality. So it can seem to be focused exclusively on any of these, but all the time, really, it's all of them at once. But it can be that power of the spirit which rejects. This gives justification to the idea of pushing away the world and living and abiding simply in the immense spiritual reality of the Atman, or the non-being, which cannot be described as Atman. Asat. Also, it can choose to support itself in universality. And Sri Aurobindo had this experience when he was in the Alipur jail, confined in jail, and he realized the omnipresent of the divine personality. Everywhere he cast his gaze, he felt it, saw it. Whatever the formulation of its nature, soul can seem to become that and view itself as that only in the frontal, active part of its consciousness. But it is never only what it seems to be. It is, too, the so much else that it can be. Secretly, it is the all of itself that is yet hidden. It is not irrevocably limited by any particular self-formulation in time, but can break through and beyond it, break it up or develop it, select, reject, new create, reveal out of itself a greater self-formulation. What it believes itself to be, by the whole active will of its consciousness as instruments, that it is, or tends to become, yo yachradaha sa eva saha. What it believes it can be and has full faith in becoming, that it changes to in nature, evolves or discovers. That's Bhagavad Gita, 17th chapter, the third shloka. In English, whatever is his faith, that indeed he is. So, believe it, you become it. Because you're summoning something from inside the infinity, which you secretly are, to come into manifestation. So the spirit presses upon the nature what it wills to achieve, and nature cannot resist. Because nature is ultimately, especially in its higher grades, self-knowing spirit. This power of the soul over its nature is of the utmost importance in the yoga of self-perfection. If it did not exist, we could never get, by conscious endeavor and aspiration, out of the fixed groove of our present imperfect human being. If any greater perfection were intended, we should have to wait for nature to effect it in her own slow or swift process of evolution. In the lower forms of being, the soul accepts this complete subjection to nature. But as it rises higher in the scale, it awakes to a sense of something in itself which can command nature. But it is only when it arrives at self-knowledge that this free will and control becomes a complete reality. So, expressed otherwise, free will is a power of spiritual realization. Free will exists, but exists when one becomes fully, consciously spirit. The change affects itself through process of nature, not therefore by any capricious magic, but an ordered development and intelligible process. When complete mastery is gained, then the process, by its self-effective rapidity, may seem a miracle to the intelligence, but it still proceeds by the law of the truth of spirit. When the divine within us, by close union of our will and being with him, takes up the yoga and acts as the omnipotent master of the nature. Sri Aurobindo ordered the choreography of yoga in seven tetrads, the Sapta Chatushtaya, as revealed to him. And the seventh, the one of Siddhi, the one of the fullest perfection, seems magical, but all has been done prior to. The preparation has been complete. No jot or tittle has been left out. Everything is done, and so the precipitation is entire when it comes. For the divine is our highest self and the self of all nature, the eternal and universal Purusha. So this is, again, the superimposition, the commingling of the divine with the human at that point of intersection in the cosmos. This is a total yoga. This is a yoga that aims at the consummation of all that the cosmos contains within it. This is nature waking to its fullest and highest possibilities. This is a yogic vision that truly integrates, that unites, that restores oneness of being and the manyness of becoming. Purusha may establish himself in any plane of being, take any principle of being as the immediate head of his power, and live in the working of its proper mode of conscious action. And so we have seen him describe this. Purusha may be placed in the mind, manomaya, in the vitality, pranamaya, in physicality, anamaya, and the Purusha is in each of those poises. But not completely, not only there, because manomaya Purusha, pranamaya Purusha, anamaya Purusha are radiations out of a central Purusha, one being, steadily maintaining itself at each level and can seemingly exclusively concentrate upon that and govern only that level. And yet, secretly always, there is the sovereign behind, the truest Purusha, Parat Purusha. The soul may dwell in the principle of infinite unity of self-existence and be aware of all consciousness, energy, delight, knowledge, will, activity, as conscious form of this essential truth, sat or satya. So here we go. We're playing in the fields of Satchit Ananda again. It may dwell in the principle of infinite conscious energy, tapas, and be aware of it, unrolling out of self-existence the works of knowledge, will, and dynamic soul action for the enjoyment of an infinite delight of the being. It may dwell in the principle of infinite self-existent delight and be aware of the divine Ananda creating out of its self-existence by its energy whatever harmony of being. In these three poises, the consciousness of unity dominates. The soul lives in its awareness of eternity, universality, unity, and whatever diversity there is not separative, but only a multitudinous aspect of oneness. It may dwell, too, in the principle of supermind, in a luminous, self-determining knowledge, will, and action which develops some coordination of perfect delight of conscious being. In the higher gnosis, unity is the basis, but it takes its joy in diversity. In lower fact of supermind, diversity is the basis, but it refers back always to a conscious unity, and it takes joy in unity. These ranges of consciousness are beyond our present level. They are super conscious to our normal mentality. That belongs to a lower hemisphere of being. So what he's rolled out for us here is Parardha, the higher level of conscious nature, of Paraprakriti, if you will, of the supreme power, Mahashakti. And it consists of Satchit Ananda Rupani, because here too, she is aware of her own being, that she is aware of her own being as an ocean of delight. Satchit Ananda. But two, she can constellate the infinity of that triune reality concordantly through this Gnostic consciousness Sri Aurobindo calls supramental. And here he speaks about two aspects of the supramental. You'll remember in The Life Divine he discusses the three poises of the supermind. Here he restrains himself to simply discussing unity and diversity. In the higher part of the supramental consciousness, unity dominates, diversity is the play of delight. In the lower, the diversity in its play takes the basis, but always refers back to the conscious unity and the joy of unity. But this is above, Parardha. Here, we live in the lower hemisphere of being, or at least may I suggest that most of us do. This lower being begins where a veil falls between soul and nature, between spirit in supermind and spirit in mind, life and body. Where this veil has not fallen, these instrumental powers are not what they are in us, but an enlightened part of the unified action of supermind and spirit. Ah, there's a link back. If we can release ourselves from this division, from this gulf that separates, if we can lose the sense of separativity, then we can rejoin what this supramental consciousness can offer. We can become that again. Mind gets to an independent idea of its own action when it forgets to refer back to the light from which it derives and becomes absorbed in the possibilities of its own separative process and enjoyment. Forgets, when it ignores, and that is the seat of ignorance. We ignore what we are more deeply, more largely, and then we believe the small gulfs in which we habituate ourselves to be the whole vastness of the sea. The soul, when it dwells in the principle of mind, not yet subject to, but user of life and body, knows itself as a mental being working out its mental life and forces and images, bodies of the subtle mental substance, according to its individual knowledge, will, and dynamis modified by its relation to other similar beings and powers in the universal mind. Manomaya Purusha, the many-sided possibilities, the diversity, but all divorced from the other. Not a conscious unity anymore. When it dwells, and remember he's talking about the soul incarnate in the world, experiencing itself through one of these instrumentations. When it dwells in the principle of life, it knows itself as a being of the universal life, working out action and consciousness by its desires under similar modifying conditions proper to a universal life soul whose action is through many individual life beings, pranamaya. When it dwells in the principle of matter, it knows itself as a consciousness of matter acting under a similar law of the energy of material being, anamaya. In proportion as it leans towards the side of knowledge, it is aware of itself more or less clearly as a soul of mind, a soul of life, a soul of body, viewing and acting in or acted upon by its nature. But where it leans towards the side of ignorance, it knows itself as an ego identified with nature of mind, of life, or of body, a creation of nature. But the native tendency of material being leads towards an absorption of the soul's energy in the act of formation and material movement and a consequent self-oblivion of the conscious being. The material universe begins from an apparent inconscience. Excuse me just a moment. The universal Purusha dwells in all these planes in a certain simultaneity and builds upon each of these principles a world or series of worlds with its beings who live in the nature of that principle. Man, the microcosm, has all these planes in his own being, range from his subconscient to his superconscient existence. By a developing power of yoga, he can become aware of these concealed worlds hidden from his physical materialized mind and senses, which know only the material world. And then he becomes aware that his material existence is not a thing apart and self-existent, as the material universe in which he lives is also not a thing apart and self-existent, but is in constant relation to the higher planes and acted on by their powers and beings. An essential point for the aspiring yogin to become aware of those higher planes and work in concert with them. He can open up and increase the action of these higher planes in himself and enjoy some sort of participation in the life of the other worlds, which for the rest are or can be his dwelling place, that is to say, the station of his awareness, Dhamma, after death or between death and rebirth in a material body. So the important thing is that one can receive, become conscious of, and receive the influence, the downward flowing forces, peace, light, power, bliss from above. As they come into us, we can become aware of them and massage them into every corner of our being. And we can, if we wish, take our station there, as he says. The station of the awareness, Dhamma, which is a Vedic term, can be above and can even be an internatal resting place. We can poise ourselves there, let the body drop away, and simply exist there until we wish or will to be born again on this verdant earth and go a voyaging along its roots again. But his most important capacity is that of developing the powers of the higher principles in himself. That means here and now, in the body. A greater power of life, a purer light of mind, the illumination of supermind, the infinite being, consciousness, and delight of spirit. By an ascending movement, he can develop his human imperfection towards that greater perfection. So he is talking about stationing here in the body the entirety of the higher consciousness, the supramental, but also the greater concordance of Satchit-Ananda, progressively, one after the other. So it would seem that the cosmic journey, this embrace of the individual in the universe with the transcendent, is unending, really is infinite. But whatever his aim, however exalted his aspiration, he has to begin from the law of his present imperfection to take full account of it and see how it can be converted to the law of a possible perfection. So as he expresses pregnantly elsewhere, from the near to the far, here and now first. Where's a good place to begin? Right where you stand or sit. Are you ready? Oh, yes. This present law of his being starts from the inconscience of the material universe, an involution of the soul in form and subjection to material nature. So we're all struggling with that. We're all dealing with that, emerging from submergence in it. An involution of the soul in form and subjection to material nature. And though in this matter, life and mind have developed their own energies, yet they are limited and bound up in the action of the lower material, which is to the ignorance of his practical surface consciousness, his original principle. We can very easily believe that we are simply material beings. And we range upwards, but we always fall back. Gravity pulls us back to our own real nature. But remember, Veda, Upanishad, Gita, all call us to remember that our roots are above and our branches extend below. No, we are really super conscient in our origin. Mind in him, though he is an embodied mental being, has to bear the control of the body and the physical life, and can only by some more or less considerable effort of energy and concentration consciously control life and body. It is only by increasing that control that he can move towards perfection. And it is only by developing soul power that he can reach it. Nature power in him has to become more and more completely a conscious act of soul, a conscious expression of all the will and knowledge of spirit. Prakriti has to reveal itself as Shakti of the Purusha. So this is the reunification. Nature, conscious of spirit, spirit expressing itself in nature, and hence yoga, union. They become one. So the psychology of self-perfection leads us to the fruition of the bodily life. in which all the spirit's powers can play, can sing, can dance, not simply individually, but concordantly, collectively, with a larger embracing humanity. And as colleagues of a cosmic nature. Sri Aurobindo's vision is immense. I think we'll come back to synthesis of yoga after some time. Always we do, always we should. Thanks for your companionship as we followed it from beginning to this point. Next week, we'll begin essays on the Gita, maybe with some background information shared with you first. But before we depart this theme tonight, I thought I'd read from Savitri, Book 1, The Book of Beginnings, and Canto 5, The Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness. This should be an assonance, which begins on page 88. A giant order was discovered here, of which the tassel and extended fringe are the scant stuff of our material lives. This overt universe, whose figures hide the secrets merged in superconscient light, wrote clear the letters of its glowing code. A map of subtle signs, surpassing thought, was hung upon a wall of inmost mind, illumining the world's concrete images into significant symbols by its gloss. It offered to the intuitive exegete its reflex of the eternal mystery. Ascending and descending twixt life's poles, the serried kingdoms of the graded law plunged from the everlasting into time. Then, glad of a glory of multitudinous mind, and rich with life's adventure and delight, and packed with the beauty of matter's shapes and hues, climbed back from time into undying self, up a golden ladder carrying the soul, tying with diamond threads the spirit's extremes. In this drop from consciousness to consciousness, each leaned on the occult inconscient's power, the fountain of its needed ignorance, arch-mason of the limits by which it lives. In this soar from consciousness to consciousness, each lifted tops to that from which it came, origin of all that it had ever been and home of all that it could still become. An organ scale of the eternal's acts, mounting to their climax in an endless calm, paces of the many-visaged wonderful, predestined stadia of the evolving way, measures of the stature of the growing soul, they interpreted existence to itself, and mediating twixt the heights and deeps, united the veiled married opposites, and linked creation to the ineffable. A last high world was seen, where all worlds meet. In its summit gleam, where night is not nor sleep, the light began of the Trinity supreme. All there discovered what it seeks for here. It freed the finite into boundlessness and rose into its own eternities. The inconscient found its heart of consciousness, the idea and feeling groping in ignorance, at last clutched passionately the body of truth, the music born in matter's silences, plucked nude out of the ineffable's fathomlessness, the meaning it had held but could not voice. The perfect rhythm now only sometimes dreamed, an answer brought to the torn earth's hungry need, rending the night that had concealed the unknown, giving to her her lost, forgotten soul. A grand solution closed the long impasse, in which the heights of mortal effort end. A reconciling wisdom looked on life. It took the striving undertones of mind and took the confused refrain of human hopes and made of them a sweet and happy call. It lifted from an underground of pain the inarticulate murmur of our lives and found for it a sense illimitable. A mighty oneness, its perpetual theme, it caught the soul's faint scattered utterances, read hardly twixt our lines of rigid thought, or mid this drowse and coma on matter's breast, heard like disjointed mutterings in sleep. It grouped the golden links that they had lost, and showed to them their divine unity, saving from the error of divided self the deep spiritual cry in all that is. All the great words that toiled to express the one were lifted into an absoluteness of light, an ever-burning revelation's fire, and the immortality of the eternal voice. There was no quarrel more of truth with truth. The endless chapter of their differences, retold in light by an omniscient scribe, traveled through difference towards unity. Mind's winding search lost every tinge of doubt, led to its end by an all-seeing speech that garbed the initial and original thought with the finality of an ultimate phrase. United were time's creative mood and tense to the style and syntax of identity. A paean swelled from the lost musing deeps, an anthem pealed to the triune ecstasies, a cry of the moment to the immortal's bliss. As if the strophes of a cosmic ode, a hierarchy of climbing harmonies, peopled with voices and with visages, aspired in a crescendo of the gods from matter's abysses to the spirit's peaks. Above were the immortals' changeless seats, white chambers of dalliance with eternity, and the stupendous gates of the alone. Across the unfolding of the seas of self appeared the deathless countries of the one. A many-miracled consciousness unrolled, vast aim and process and unfettered norms.